Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, I'm David Kern.
And I'm Heidi White.
And you're listening to Close Reads, a podcast for the incurable reader. Heidi, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, David. It's good to be here. It's a rare occurrence, so it's good to
It's a rare occurrence that it's good to be here?
No, it's, oh man, my joke is ruined. Now I'm going to feel like glory.
Flummoxed?
Flummoxed. I'm so flummoxed.
Flummoxed like glory.
You can't recover.
That's the name. That should be the name of the sequel to this book. Should have been Flummoxed.
Flummoxed like glory.
So we are here to discuss Marilyn Robinson's Home. We're going to discuss pages 100 through 150. And we're right in the thick of things as far as this book goes. Next week, when we discuss the next section, roughly pages 150 through 200, Sarah Jane Bentley will be joining us. You've listened to her a time or two on the show, and she's going to be filling in for Tim, who, if you've been listening, you know that he just moved, and he's helping take care of his dad, who has been having some health problems. So keep Tim, continue to keep Tim in your prayers, if you would. He also just had a birthday, so I think I mentioned that last week, but shout out to Tim for taking care of his family and all the things that he has going home. We're thinking about you, man. Before we get into 50 pages or so, I want to remind you about Scholae Academy. If you would like to discover classical, restful tutoring online, then Scholae Academy's personalized tutoring services might be the perfect fit for you. Their team of master teachers and classical tutors is available year-round to help your students find confidence and delight in their studies. You can choose from supplemental tutoring or private full-course instruction in subjects such as Latin, writing, grammar, mathematics, logic, history, and more. Pricing and scheduling are flexible. If you head over to Scholae Academy, that's SCHOLEacademy.com, you can learn more and you can also submit a tutoring request. So once again, that is SCHOLEacademy.com and that's spelled SCHOLEacademy.com. Thanks so much to them and our friends over there for sponsoring Close Reads this month and helping make it possible. Also, before we dive in, I want to remind you that we have begun our conversation of The Lord of the Rings. By the time this goes up, well, there'll still only be one episode, but then early next week, the next one will go up on that. And we've discussed the first chapter so far, so we'll dive into the next couple chapters. And if you would like to get access to that, you can head over to patreon.com/closereads to join the Patreon page. You can also, of course, follow along with all of our Close Reads conversations over on Facebook and on Instagram. Over on Facebook, we've got our Close Reads podcast discussion group. And on Instagram, we are at Close Reads Pods Podcasts. And then we have our newsletter. That's closereads.substack.com. So we've got that stuff out of the way. We've got the admin out of the way, the business out of the way. So we can dive into pages 100 through 150. Heidi, last week we talked a lot about the sadness of this book. Mm-hmm. And you texted me with thoughts on the sadness of this book, and you can bring those up later if you want. But do you feel like it's more sad now that we're 150 pages in? Less sad?
That's
the same
question.
Sad? Where is it on your sadness quotient?
My sad meter, yes.
Your sad meter, exactly, yeah.
So I spend, my kids go to school full time now. I used to homeschool them and now they're at school. And so I'm at home working all the time and I'm alone most of the time. So I was just like thinking about how sad it is to be like home alone for hours at a time, reading Marilyn Robinson.
There's so many people listening to this right now that are like, just like, hating you right now that you get to be home alone reading a book.
Because I'm alone. And I do realize how blessed I am to be at home reading a book. I'm just saying, sitting at home in a big empty house reading Marilyn Robinson, it's an existential experience. I mean, your question about is it more sad, less sad? same sad is
hashtag same sad.
Same sad. It's a good question. I feel like the book's taken a turn, right? It was all these, we talked a lot last week about how quiet they are, how they're not talking. And now they are talking, but they keep missing each other. So like saying the wrong thing. I mean, how many?
But they're making attempts. At least they're making attempts.
You're really good at counting stuff. You're like 17 times someone said this or Dr. Sanders' face or whatever. That's like.
I have nothing like that this time.
Oh, good. Me neither. But it does seem like they're trying to connect and sometimes are, but there's a lot more talking and more misunderstanding and then some actual real, I think, meaningful connections. But it's taken a turn. And I think it's maybe same sad. I think to answer the question, I think it's maybe same sad. Hashtag. Actually, the hashtag comes first. I do know that.
It does. Hashtag it does. Same yes. sad. Good job. you really are flummoxed.
Putting like hashtags after phrases on social media, like some kind of baby boomer.
When it's after, I think they call it a pound sign. if you'd like to leave a message, press the pound sign. Press that hashtag button. Yeah.
So I think it's same sad because, because they keep missing each other.
So I meant to get a clarification on this last week. And then after the episode, I realized, well, shoot, I forgot to get a clarification on this. Do you find that sadness to be, I don't want to call it negative because I don't want to say that you're like criticizing her approach. Right. You can if you want, but do you find that difficult, I guess is what I would say. Like, do you find that to be, I'm not even talking about flaws, I guess. I'm just talking about...
Right. Yes, diminish
the experience for you. Yeah. Okay, but then let's go back to the question that you brought up one of the previous episodes, in which you said you'd like to discuss it in comparison to Wendell Berry, for example. Mm-hmm. Wendell Berry's books are very sad. So, do you find that same sadness to be difficult, or do you find the Wendell Berry sadness to be difficult in his books, in the way that you find it to be difficult in Marilyn Robinson's books?
That's a good question. And I want to hear your answer to it too, but no, it's different because, and I did say this last week that, not in reference to Wendell Berry, but just the heaviness of Marilyn Robinson is unmitigated in the books, I think.
Right. And yeah, you did say that.
In Wendell Berry, there's this, these threads of gold, right? This weaving through of a transforming love and an ability to connect as a community and a restoration and forgiveness that happens continually again and again, so that the sadness is harmonized with the joy. And I feel like that's more indicative of a fully human life than just this unrelenting weight of grief and sadness that you find in Marilyn Robinson. I'm not saying that that's doesn't happen, but I would love to see some threads of gold. I feel like that would make the book's more realistic. I don't know. What do you think?
I mean, I honestly don't know what I think about the question.
What about the Wendell Berry part? Do you find the sadness the same kind of weight in Wendell Berry? Because you're right. His books are sad.
I don't. It's tough for me. It's like, I've never really thought about books this way before. Mm. Like, I don't read a book and go, well, this is really sad. I don't have like a sort of visceral response to it that makes it challenging for me. And I don't know why that is. I think I'm just not in tune with my feelings. No, I don't know why exactly that's not something that I notice. So it's like a difficult, I don't feel it in the same way.
Do you feel sad? Like if you're reading Marilyn Robinson, this is an interesting conversation to me because it's different kinds of reading, right? Like, do you feel sad when you read a sad book, or do you kind of have more of like a, you are paying a lot of attention to the craft.
What do you mean by sad?
What do I mean by sad? Like, you know, the feeling you have when you're sad about something in your life. Do you have that when you read a sad book?
No.
Okay.
No,
but you can objectively know this is sad, but it doesn't feel like haunting to you or disturbing to you.
Is it different to feel sad about something than it is to be caught up in the pathos of a story?
I don't know. How would you, what do you mean by pathos?
Well, I mean, do you mean like the Aristotelian definition? Because I might need to Wikipedia that for the exact language real quick here. No, I mean like the idea that there is an emotional, like I think I accept the terms of the emotional weight of a story.
Right.
And I'm willing and like can, in a way that allows me to feel for the characters, that allows me to root for or against characters, that makes me feel hopeful that a character can change or frustrated that they're not changing. I think that maybe when I read a book like this, frustration actually might be the better word than sadness, because I think what I know, what I recognize is, like, for example, when they can't say something, when they try to connect and miss each other, to use the phrasing that we've talked about the last couple of weeks, I think for me, I would say that is like, I like kind of feel the dramatic tension that happens there and the frustration as a reader that comes out of that, because like, just say what you need to say so you can connect, you know, like it's almost like yelling at the TV screen or something. Or like when you're watching a horror movie, like don't go down. This is dumb. Don't go down there. There's obviously going to be a guy down there with an axe, right? Now this is different than that, but it's the same sort of experience. It's like a similar experience. Hmm. I don't know that when I read Marilyn Robinson at any rate that I feel sadness the way that you're describing, and maybe it really is that I'm not in tune with my feelings.
Or maybe you're just a little bit more objective when you read books. I get really emotionally involved in books. So I think that it's just a different way of reading. There's nothing right or wrong about either way, but I get like entangled up in the emotions of a book, and I allow that. I like that about reading. So
I'm not making any kind of assertion when I ask this question.
No.
Do you think that women and men read those sort of things on average differently? Like, there's obviously outliers in both groups. There are plenty of cold-hearted women. No, I'm just
so true.
I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know. I think that's a fair question. And it's probably true. It's probably, I mean,
which I'm doesn't, I don't mean very, to diminish either side, no, when I say that.
I know. I don't feel like you are. I think that that's true, because I really welcome that. I know how to, you know, have appropriate emotional responses to things. So I when I read, I like the feeling of getting lost in a story, mm-hmm. and kind of feeling the weight of what the characters are feeling. And
do you dislike the weight of the feeling of being sad, though? I know I interrupted you, but
yeah, I do. I think that this book feels a little, and Marilyn Robinson in general, and this, I really do. I'm about to make a statement that's going to sound like an unkind judgment. I don't mean it that way. It's a little bit much for me. And it isn't just because it's this weight of sadness. It's because it's the only emotion explored in these books. Mm. Like, I feel like there's no other in Marilyn Robinson's body of work. She's a brilliant writer and an incredible novelist, like craft. But I think grief and sadness is the only like emotion explored in any depth in her books. Hmm. And I don't think that's indicative of most people's human existence.
Hmm. That last part is probably true. I'm trying to decide if I agree with the first part that she doesn't explore other emotions. And then I'm also trying to figure out if I think that is, say that's true, then is that a problem? Because in a way, like a story can only tell a snapshot of a life. Like you're only like, I mean, even a book that's like about you know, covers the gamut of like from birth to death, you know, even it can still only capture so much. And this is about, you know, a very limited amount of time when very fraught things are happening. And so I'm wondering, I mean, in a sense, isn't the point of the book that people are, maybe your comments about how it's just too much for you is just the fair response to it, or a bit much, or whatever you said. But because isn't this book about people who are trying to work out the grief that they have and then find the glimmers of, I mean, isn't that like the central problem of the book?
Yes. Yeah, it is. I think the central problem of the book. And I think that they have a real, all of them, and not just in this book, but in Gilead and Housekeeping, which are the only one I haven't read, Lila. Mm. And I obviously haven't read Jack either.
right.
I do think they have meaningful connections. And I don't think this is the modern novel in the sense that, you know, a lot of modern novels kind of explore the modern problem of people being lonely and disconnected and kind of drifting through life in this interstitial space of loneliness. These are family books about connections. And they're pretty unique, I think, in the American canon, especially by a writer of such a faith, who's willing to kind of engage with the depth of this side of human existence. And so I think they're brilliant novels. And it's not that it's, I want to be clear, it's not that it like feels too sad for me. They are sad and I engage with that. It's more like, well, what else do they feel? What else? Like what kind of meaningful happiness do these people have? Like they kind of mention it in passing, like the house is busy and happy and there's people over. And
well, let's talk about that then. Let's talk about that this week. Like, where do we find, you know, you mentioned that in this section, it seems like they're starting to connect in some ways. They're not just like shooting past each other. So where do we find some examples of them finding happiness or whatever? I mean, is it truly absent? Because in many ways, you continually see them reaching for it. So for example, I think we see this in very small things, like when Boughton asks Jack to play the piano, when they read, when he is working on the car, when they're sitting and talking and she's making coffee for him. When they, you know, like there's these constant little attempts to reach for pleasure. Sometimes they're fulfilling and sometimes they're not. And when they don't live up to the expectation, that's when they're least likely to be something that makes them actually happy. Like, it seems like Boughton says he wants them to, Jack to read to him or play the piano to him, and he has this expectation that it's going to lead to some sort of peace. And when it doesn't, it sort of frustrates him. And so there's all these moments where that's happening. Would you say then that there are any moments where they do actually reach it? Or is that kind of what the sadness is, that when they reach, it's just not possible?
I think that in this section that we read this week, that that little vignette about them reading the book about Africa, that has this like really horrifying ending, by the way. Oh, never heard of that book before. Won't be reading it. but that moment.
146 and 147, if anybody wants to go back and read the thing that Heidi says she's not going to read.
They have an actual connection when they're enjoying each other's company. When Boughton seems to forget for a moment that he's trying to convert Jack and save Jack and protect him from hell, and actually just has a good time with him. Which I think is the part that's missing from, like you pointed out, when he asked Jack to play the piano. Like, always hanging over Boughton's head is this existential fear for Jack, and it characterizes all every interaction that they have. And I get that. I'm a parent. Like, it's not that I reject the sadness. I really am embracing. I'm in it. I just don't think it tells the whole story about human life.
And to be fair, we haven't read the whole story.
That's so true. But up till now, that's
right,
true.
Right. No.
And I do know how Marilynne Robinson books end too. I don't know how this one ends. And she may be like just intentionally doing that. I mean, like, these are books about this one thing. And I think that's valid. So
obviously there are some people who don't, you know, love her work, but why do you think her work is so popular? I mean, even among people that aren't people of faith, her books are so highly regarded. I mean, she won the Pulitzer Prize, which is something Wendell Berry hasn't, which I don't mean that as a criticism. I just mean that there is a certain degree of notoriety and fame and readership that she has acquired in the literary world, mm-hmm. which, you know, actually is a world that Berry kind of himself just actively rejected. So, you know,
right.
Why do you think that, I mean, there is a literariness to her work. There's a serious novel element to her, mm-hmm. or to her work, which is why I think that it's, you know, or she is one of the great serious novel writers of our time, at least in our country. But then what is it about them that makes it so beloved, even beyond, like, so many of our listeners, for example, who are, you know, moms raising their kids and homeschooling and things like that, or teachers or whatever, love her work. And so it goes far beyond the literary establishment that gives up Pulitzer Prizes, so to speak. So where do you think that comes from? Roundabout, long-winded way of asking a question I could have just said in like six words.
Well, I mean, what you just said, she's a beautiful writer. And this is a real part of human existence. Like this question of how is it possible to love someone so much and yet completely miss them all the time? Like, that's like a great, like a very deep human mystery. And it's there's some kind of comfort in an author who's brave enough to take that on and make something out of it. And I think she has earned her play. I think she deserves all of her. I mean, she's digging into these relationships that are also representative of larger issues of faith and of American culture, and just her writing's absolutely lovely. Mm-hmm. So I think that in what I'm saying, I want it to be really clear that I think this is an incredible novel. I think she's an amazing novelist.
Yeah.
I don't know. Do you see those glimpses of joy that you asked me if I see? Do you see them? Am I just missing them? Maybe I am.
The point of fiction is absence. So, like, sometimes that just means that there is a clue absent that's going to help you solve a mystery. And, like, it's very, you know, direct and specific
when
in that way.
When you say the point of fiction is absence, I love that. I think it's true. But what do you mean by that?
Well, okay, so on the one hand, it's what people talk all the time about the idea of a story is that someone wants something, and then they go on some sort of a quest. And I'm using the word quest very loosely to get that thing that they want, right? Like, that's the sort of archetypal language that people use when talking about fiction. So it could be, you know, they're on a quest for a treasure. They're on the quest to get home. They're on the quest to throw the ring into the fire. They're on a quest to, you know, convince the girl to marry them. Whatever it is, right? To get her to make a home. Whatever it is. So in some ways, it's just like there is something absent, and the plot is driven by the idea that I'm going to fill that absence with something specific. And then. Otherwise, but sometimes it could be something more abstract, like it's a story about people who are sad, and that sadness comes from something that's missing, and so then the story is ostensibly about filling that hole. So, I think that when we talk about the happiness, the question of happiness, or those little moments or whatever, I think that's hard to answer at this point, because I think that in some ways that's what the book is just about. It's like, I think he comes home because he is looking for that. I think peace is often tied to filling some kind of hole that hasn't created, or it's like filling some sort of absence. To have peace, you either have to fill an absence or you have to be able to make sense of an absence. And I think that in many ways, this is a book about people who are trying to, all three of them are trying to do those two things.
Right.
Are there moments of happiness? I think that there's a lot of laughter in this section, I noticed.
Yeah.
In particular, she makes a very strong point to say in between things that they say to each other, Jack and Gloria are laughing at each other. They laugh to the point where they're crying in multiple instances. In fact, earlier in this section, first Jack does it, and then later on, I believe, Gloria does it. And like those two scenes seem to mirror each other. And so I find that really interesting, that the deeper we go into the book, the more laughter there is, the more music there is, the more work there is. Whereas at the beginning, there was a lot of sitting around, a lot of closed blinds, a lot of reading, ironically, but just a lot of being alone. And in this section, as we go farther, there's a lot more things that are being done corporately. And the interesting thing is that by this point in the book, it's not Jack who is the one who's left out. It's actually their father. Mm-hmm. Because most of the interactions that are meaningful are between Jack and Glory. Even as they're a little fraught at times, they also have some moments where they're able to let their guard down, and Jack is feeling more and more comfortable. And that leaves the old man kind of the odd one out most of the time. And so I think that that makes sense within the narrative, because Boughton has been hurt by Jack's absence and Jack's behavior as a child in a way that Glory wasn't, that was much more abstract for her. And so she has her brother back, and that they've been able to connect. But there's something deeper that's between Jack and Boughton that has to be worked towards. And so I think that those little moments come in, those little moments of happiness and those laughters of are symbols or signals of reconciliation between Glory and Jack. And thus, I think they're meant to at least suggest the sort of happiness that you're, I think, looking for. Does that make sense? Mm. I think that that Robinson tends to write with what I would kind of call a sort of sleight of hand, where she's not going to do many things that are like, here's the moment you're looking for and it's going to hit you in the face, you know?
Right. And you're going to know for sure. Good. That's just, I completely agree. And that's just being a good novelist. Like, you don't want to make, I think... Because I don't disagree with anything you're saying. I think that everything you're saying is true. I think what I'm sensing as I read this novel, and especially because I have Wendell Berry in mind, mm-hmm. which maybe isn't fair, but it is true. Like the kind of the contemplation of the life.
Comparison is one of the best ways we can understand books. So
right. That they're both taking on very similar themes. Faith, tradition, small town America, the changing American culture in the middle of the 20th century. And they're both taking that on from their own unique perspectives. And I think it's a worthwhile thing to do. I think what I see in Wendell Berry that's different from Marilyn Robinson is that there's this... I think of how to put this.
Is it have to do with like a sort of more positive sense of like an inherent goodness in people?
Maybe. I mean, in that I do want to talk about that. There's a very, very different, even though they're both people of faith and both identify as Christians, there's a very different set of theological assumptions and underpinnings and political assumptions and underpinnings that come from that, from each of them, even though they're doing the same thing. I think what I see in Wendell Berry that's different from Marilyn Robinson is that Wendell Berry is writing about beyond the home, right? And this is about the home and the home as a metaphor for the soul. That's what we're talking about with Marilynne Robinson. And with Marilynne Robinson, she is exploring, like, I think her novel as a writer, as a craftsman, like, it's incredible. Mm-hmm. As a representative of the ordinary human experience, I think it misses a lot. And doesn't do enough honor to what does actually make a meaningful human life. And I think that that is something that Wendell Berry is very intentional about. He's like, I know that life is sad. It's also good. I know that life is good and it's also sad. And
he's being purposeful about identifying those things that break through the sadness.
Letting them be explored in his novels as just this kind of tangled up human experience. And like, I come from a super dysfunctional family. I have lots and lots of happy memories from being a child. And I think that with Marilynne Robinson, there's just this weight of a single exploration of a unifying theme. And I think it misses some of what these people probably did experience. I mean, and I'm going to give you an example of this. She calls herself, Glory has that comment when she's sitting and reading the Bible on the porch. And she has a conversation with Jack. It's a lovely conversation that she has with Jack when he says, please save me, little sister. And she's like, I don't know how to do that. And it's a wonderful conversation. Mm-hmm. And she has this like internal monologue about her own personal piety and devotion. Mm-hmm. And she calls herself a pious person. Mm-hmm. Right. And there's absolutely no indication that she has any kind of real sense of what she's doing, right? To pray and to read scripture on a daily basis and to call yourself pious, but get nothing out of it. And I'm not sure that that's a full expression of faith. It's absolutely not a full expression of faith. And maybe that's the point. And you might be about to say that. I'm arguing what you're about. But like, and maybe that is the point. But I don't think that's indicative of most Christian families. That like you don't, that a girl at 38 years or 36 years old or however old she's 38 can sit there and read the Bible and pray and not have any sense that it should be more than just the form. It seems to be a claim on Robinson's part that it isn't more than the form. And I don't know if she would agree with that or not, but there's such like an emphasis on the emptiness in this family's life that I'm like, there had to be some kind of fullness somewhere, right?
Well, isn't that kind of what they're saying so often though? Like they're looking back at their memories and they're saying, we had these memories and yet we feel empty. What do we do? Like, what's the why?
Right, right. Right. And I don't think the novel offers a satisfying answer to that. And again, we're only halfway through.
Right.
We're only halfway through. But yeah. I don't see...
So you're saying that's the thing you're looking for.
Yeah. I'm looking for some kind of reason that everything is so meaningless. Even prayer, even scripture, even, you know, like, why though? So...
Okay, let's talk about that.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
So what I'm really mean is, okay, so the term objective correlative, this always comes full circle, right? We always end up talking about objective correlatives. Objective correlative comes from an essay that T.S. Eliot wrote about Hamlet. And what he says that Hamlet is an artistic failure on Shakespeare's part. Mm-hmm. And his point is because there is nothing in the play that explains his extreme angst, anxiety, and existential crisis. There's no objective correlative. There's no explanation that is sufficient to Hamlet's failure to be able to engage meaningfully and make decisions and all that. He says, so basically just Shakespeare made up this character and didn't give him a reason to be so tormented and then asks us to believe in that. I think, and I'm looking, I have the same complaint about Marilynne Robinson sometimes.
Which character, though?
All of them. Maybe not Boughton, his anxiety and is, I think, existent. I think there is an objective correlative to his, to him, because he has this lost son and he has this set of theological principles that say that his son is going to be damned for all eternity. And or so might be. And so that to me is an objective correlative enough. I don't see it for the kids. I wish. So I think that's what I mean of like, well, then why so, are they just but, okay. so sad all the time?
I think, but isn't that the thing that Robinson, devil's advocate here. I mean,
yeah, no, it's good.
Jack keeps saying so often, like there's that conversation in this section where he's talking to Boughton and he basically, it's when Boughton asks him to come over and sit next to him, right? Mm-hmm. And Jack basically says, I don't know why I did the things that I did. Mm-hmm. I don't know why. I think maybe it was actually a conversation with Glory, but the point is he says, I don't know why I couldn't, that I felt so strange. I couldn't be a part of things. I don't know why I couldn't follow in the footsteps of the rest of the family.
Right.
And so in a sense, he doesn't know what the objective correlative is for his own behavior. And ultimately, the book asks the question of, is there any objective correlative, but that there is a sort of decree that has been passed right. down by he who orders the universe.
Right.
And what does that mean if so? Yeah. Like, what if that is the case, if we accept that as our... the worldview by which we're, or the not bigger than a worldview, mm-hmm. the sort of terms upon which we all exist, yeah. then what does that mean about how we interact with the people that we love and understand our own behavior?
Right.
Go on. What were you going
to say? No, I think you're exactly right. And I think that the doctrine of predestination is the only objective correlative that makes this, the heaviness and the weight of this novel make any sense. And Marilyn Robinson is a Calvinist. So what she has given us is, as far as we know, that caveat, a vessel set apart for destruction in Jack. And then everything, and that breaks everything. That breaks everything. It breaks the family. It breaks each individual soul. But I think that... And that is probably the best explanation for an objective correlative, for a reason for this weight that permeates these novels. In that case, then we're, I don't know, that opens up, I don't know, maybe a can of worms. But it's, and maybe that's what it's meant to do.
So we get this section in the middle of this, we get this passage in the middle of the section we read for this week, middle-ish, where he's not eating. And she basically is like, you need to eat. You need to eat. And he's like, no, I'm not hungry. And she alludes to Raskolnikov.
Yep.
Let's see if I can find it. I put a bookmark in it. Okay, here we go. 1:30. What would you like for breakfast? A little more coffee. No, you're going to eat something. If you want to look like Raskolnikov, all right. Otherwise, you had better start eating. It would probably help you sleep. I'm going to make pancakes, which I like the notion of the Russian tie to pancakes. Oh, please, no, not pancakes. You have to let me work up to this. French toast, oatmeal, eggs and toast. Now I'm Raskolnikov. Just yesterday, I was Cary Grant. You don't eat and you don't sleep. That's what happens. I'll make you French toast. Okay. So then that conversation goes on. There's a lot here. But this, the way Robinson phrases this from Glory, if you want to look like Raskolnikov, all right. And of course, Raskolnikov is a tortured soul who commits a crime almost because he wants to feel something. Right. So that's a very oversimplification. If you want to avoid the oversimplification, then you can go to our Patreon page and you can listen to months of episodes on that book that we just finished up recently. But she doesn't say, you look like Raskolnikov or you are Raskolnikov. She says, if you want to look like Raskolnikov, okay, don't eat. In a way, it kind of sets her up to be a sort of Sonya type character here. Mm-hmm. You know, this character who, despite what he thinks of himself, despite what the world thinks of him, and despite what he deserves, you know, is loyal to him. And that it, the theological underpinnings between Crime and Punishment in this book are very different. And yet they're both dealing with questions of like depravity and tortured souls. And they're both deeply psychological novels. And so one of the questions that I was thinking about is as a psychological novel, how does it, it's like a psychological novel that has to somehow jive with the doctrine of predestination. And so as much as it is like, how do I interact with somebody else who seems like maybe they've been predetermined to mm-hmm. be damned forever, there's also this sense of like, how do I exist as myself if I feel a fear that I might be damned to some degree?
Right.
In Raskolnikov, is the book suggesting here that he is on the way to becoming a Raskolnikov and then ultimately that's going to be the solution? It seems to me that he's placed, like the book is placing him on a Raskolnikov continuum. So is he like...
What are the sides of the continuum?
Well, there's the before the murder and after the murder continuum, okay. At least if you're looking at Crime and Punishment. So, I mean, maybe he is in some way in the... He's Raskolnikov when Crime and Punishment is over. Like he's Raskolnikov at prison in prison in Siberia at the end and she's bringing him food every day. Until he eventually gets out. And so I guess the question I have is, I guess the basic question is, what's with the allusion to Raskolnikov here that I'm trying to work out as I'm thinking aloud here? And then what does that have to do with this doctrine of predestination with the Calvinism that's sort of at the heart of this book?
Oh man. So I think I changed my mind from the beginning of the episode until now that, because you ask good questions. So if Jack is, and I actually have heard interviews with Robinson in which she does allude to Jack as being kind of a thought experiment on the doctrine of double predestination. So if Jack is intended to be a question mark of the soul that is chosen for damnation, or set apart for damnation is a better word for that, a better, much more accurate, Calvinistically accurate statement. if he is set apart for destruction, then what kind of impact would that make on the people that love him? Especially if those people are marked for salvation. And that is more than sufficient objective correlative for the sadness of this book.
Well, it's interesting that you say that because I mentioned Sonya. And if there's one thing that Sonya believes, it's that there is nobody. She's like the opposite of someone who believes in predestination in many ways. Yep. Like she knows more about him than he knows about himself, basically. And yet she believes that no one is ultimately condemned to destruction or set apart for destruction. Right. So I just find it fascinating that Marilyn Robinson drops that reference in here and sets Gloria apart as this Sonya-like character through that illusion.
Great observation.
Especially given that Marilyn Robinson herself is a Calvinist. And to me, that suggests not that the book is like dogmatic about the theology, but that it asks questions about the theology, that it's like exploring the theology that she believes in, and that she has defended in essays and things like that, talks, essays. So to me, it makes that becomes really compelling, because if the characters run, if Sonya in Crime and Punishment is the opposite, is sort of like representative of an opposite belief to what Robinson herself seems to buy into, then what does it mean that the protagonist, the main character, the character whose perspective we're in for this novel about predestination, what does it mean if she is representative or at least an allusion to a character who is the opposite of that.
Right.
So to me, it makes the book, it opens the book up to being way more questioning than it is dogmatic about the theology, even if we have this character like Boughton and Jack's own, for lack of a better word, depravity hovering over the story. And to me, right. that actually suggests a sort of hopefulness about in Robinson's mind about a character like Jack.
How so?
Because it's suggesting that it's at least exploring the idea that he's not condemned, that he's not set apart for destruction.
By comparing him to Raskolnikov, you mean?
Yeah, and then bringing the glory, like, but yeah. I mean, I think it's at least asking the question. I don't think that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't want to talk about that till the end, actually.
Right. I've read Gilead. I know how this ends, but some of our readers don't, our listeners don't. It takes place at a concurrent time.
Right.
Which is what's really interesting and brilliant about this series of novels. Like, it's each of them is standalone, explores the same circumstances from different characters' perspective, bringing in different things that overlap and then some completely new idea. It's really cool. They're incredibly well written and brilliantly crafted. But I like your point about Sonia and Glory, and I hadn't made that connection. I really appreciate that Sonia is Raskolnikov's path to salvation because she never, ever, ever gives up on him. And in many ways, as we talked about in the Patreon episodes, allows him to abuse her, not in a physically violent sense, but through because of the distortion and this disruption and the sickness in his own soul. He's cruel to her over and over again, and she loves him faithfully through it. And it is in that that he finds his salvation. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing a very similar dynamic play out in Home.
Yeah, and it strikes me that Glory is trying to figure out, in a way, what is her commitment to him? What is her help for him going to mean?
Yes. She's more honest about it than Sonia is about the impact on her. And when she says to him, haven't you ever considered that there's anybody as miserable as you? There's more than one miserable person in this house. And she's calling him on a lot of important things that and in some ways get to his heart more than his father's able to do, because his father's so focused on his behavior. You know, did you go out drinking last night? Are you the thief that's stealing from the drugstore? You know, but in a very kind of passive aggressive roundabout way.
They call that Midwestern.
Okay. Good to know.
As a Midwesterner. I just offended a bunch of my people from the Midwest, but they would never tell me though.
But it's Glory who's like directly saying, you're not the only miserable person here. I told you I didn't want to talk about that. And you keep bringing it up and making fun of me for it. Like there's a lot of things that Glory gets to. She has this ability to kind of address the real sins of Jack, not the perceived sins of Jack. And that's, I think, really important and, you know, could potentially be a Sonia-like influence on him if he were to be able to receive that with humility.
Well, it strikes me that influence, that's a good word, because influence is a big part of this section. So, you know, especially, well, this whole on page 114 and 115. Mm-hmm. I'll just read a little passage here.
Yeah.
Jack sat down at the piano, tinkered at the keys for a moment, found the tune and played it through. His father did not sing. Now whispering hope. Yes, sir. When the song ended, his father said, making my heart in its sorrow rejoice. That can actually happen. I've had that experience. Hope is a very valuable thing, since there is not always so much to rejoice about in this life. Jack went to stand in his father's doorway to spare him the effort of raising his voice. The old man said, come here, Jack. Bring the chair over here. There's something I need to say to you. You're probably going to have to forgive me for this. I'll do my best. Well, I know that. I can count on that. And you're a grown man now. Jack laughed. True. So I want to put a question to you. All right? Go ahead. I feel I didn't do right by you. I wasn't a good father to you. What? Really? No, it's a feeling I've always had, almost since you were a baby, as though there was something you needed from me and I never figured out what it was. Jack cleared his throat. I really don't know what to say. I've always thought you were a very good father, much better than I deserved. And then I want to skip ahead a little bit because Boughton says, I just never knew another child who didn't feel at home in the house where he was born. Jack says, I can't explain that. And then a little bit ahead, I always felt it was sadness I was dealing with, a sort of heavy-heartedness in a child. And how could I be angry at that? I should have known how to help you with it. So in this section here, we get this question of influence coming up. But they're trying to grapple with what it means. Because he says, I wasn't a good father to you. It's interesting to me, by the way, that he says, I want to put a question to you. And then another never asks a question.
Never asks.
He just says,
question.
I feel I didn't do right by you. I wasn't a good father to you. It's just a statement. So that's interesting. But he's saying, I'm part of the reason. Like, I was never able to reach you. And so I'm part of the reason why you are the way you are now and why the way you were then. And Jack's saying, look, I can't explain this. Like, I can't give you a reason for my behavior that is going to help you understand things. And yet, and then at the same time, Boughton is saying, I couldn't do anything. And yet you were just born this way. You were born sad. And he's like, as an innocent child, you were sad and I could never reach that. And so for Boughton, to me, it's like, this is the central conflict in him where he's saying, this child needed something I couldn't give him, but if he was born this way, what could I ever offer him in the first place? And the thing is, he brings it to Jack to help explain. And Jack's like, I don't know. I can't, if I knew the answer to this, we would have solved these problems years ago. And so that in a book that's about whether or not people are damned,
right, can be saved. Yeah.
And then the idea of, that's why I think this coming and then a little bit after that coming, this question about Sonia and the idea of Sonia being part of Raskolnikov's salvation is just such a fascinating juxtaposition, because Robinson is like actively, I wouldn't say she's struggling, but she's actively presenting different options here in terms of how to work out what the theology is in real people. Like, she is trying, to me, what happens here is whatever you actually believe about her theology, she is trying to de-abstract the theology. And I find that really, important thing. I find that to be a really important work that she's doing.
I agree. Yep, I agree. What I think is fascinating about Robinson, though, is that, and this I think really is just an unflinching genius, like that she's not indicting it. She's exploring it. She's saying like, this is what it would look like.
Yeah.
And that's why I said, I take back everything I said about the objective correlative in the story, because not only is that sufficient to explain this family, it's sufficient to explain every sad thing in every life ever. If like there's, it's sufficient to explain all human sadness. If there is no way for somebody to be saved.
Yeah.
Like that's right. That. And he talks about that on, what page is it? 143. And that, when he's having a conversation
about perdition.
With Glory. Yes. And Glory says to him, he dreamed about you before you wrote to him, before he knew you were coming. You were always on his mind all those years. It isn't having you here that makes him worry. And Jack replies, then it's what? My existence, I suppose? My hapless, disreputable existence? And from his point of view, I can't even put an end to it. There is no end to it. I'll always be somewhere in eternity, rotting or writhing. The poor old devil feels responsible for my soul.
Glory's response to that, though, is interesting. He never said one thing in his life about rotting or writhing.
Yeah. And then he says something. Hold on.
True. It was always perdition, wasn't it? I finally looked the word up in the dictionary. The utter loss of the soul or of final happiness in a future state, semicolon, future misery or eternal death. And by the way, I just want to say, Marilyn Robinson is very funny. Because like dropping that semicolon line in there shows so much personality in Jack and is actually quite humorous in the midst of a very dark part. So I reject the notion of Marilyn Robinson not being funny. I don't reject the notion that she's very sad.
Yeah, you're right. There's a lot of humor in these conversations. But it's not a humor that lifts the sadness, which to your point, could be part of the brilliance of her writing. Like that's the incredible nature of the craft. And, but he's right. Like there's no way to set Fountain free of his worry. This is a deep parental anxiety.
He doesn't even want to die.
There's no way to relieve this anxiety. If no matter where, if he's there, he's a constant reminder to his father. If he's gone, he's lost and his father's worried. If he's dead, he's even more lost. And that, I think, is, again, more than sufficient to explain the sadness of the book. And it's, but what's interesting to me about Marilyn Robinson, like I just said, is that she's not rejecting this idea. She's not indicting it. She's just saying, this is what it means. Like, this is what it means to believe this.
Well, you know, he says, that sounds all very Presbyterian right before this. And she says, well, there are worse things. And he says, oh, believe me, I'm well aware that there are.
I don't know, though. Maybe there are. Maybe so. Maybe. I can't think of one as a parent.
You can't think of anything worse than a Presbyterian? What?
I can't think of anything worse than believing, being haunted by the fear that my child is predestined for damnation.
Oh.
I can't think of anything worse than that.
Yeah.
So that is the exploration here. And maybe that's why they keep missing each other. So, yeah.
Well, obviously, you know, she says, why don't you tell him a story that you're have a different sort of faith or whatever. And then he says, you want me to lie about the state of my soul? And she's like, yeah, it's just an idea. For the sake of their father. And like, that's one of the questions that's hovering over the rest of the novel is, what is the state of Jack's soul? And that's, it's difficult to really get a sense of what he actually believes and doesn't believe. It's kind of what makes him an enigma and complicated and a good fictional character.
What do you make of that conversation they have about when Glory kind of suggests without saying it that he should just tell his father that he believes? And he says, that's my one scruple.
He says he won't be a hypocrite.
Yes. Like, how do you read that? Do you read that as like moral courage or is it a scruple worth having? I have a couple thoughts on it, but I want to hear yours. Like, I thought that was a significant conversation and really interesting.
I read it. I mean, on first blush anyway, I read it. I read it as a sort of I read it as both a moral courage and sort of not very self-aware. Because I don't think it's like, I mean, he's saying, I want to be honest about this. So there is a moral courage to that. But also like he says he's not a hypocrite, but I mean, he also is. So,
Right. Why is that the one thing he can't say?
Yeah. I mean, I think he recognizes the severity, like that there's the question of the fate of one's soul is serious.
Right.
And he recognizes that to lie about it, if everything that his father believes is true, then to lie about it it's not going to mean anything. So there's a weight to it and a seriousness to it that I think he at least accepts. He might not, because with Jack, I don't know I think Jack believes the basic premises. Like, Jack to me is not a nihilistic, this agnostic, pure atheistic character.
Right. He wouldn't be so tormented if he was.
Right. I think he's a character who, like Raskolnikov, and maybe this is where the comparison really comes in, like Raskolnikov, believes in the existence of God, but feels like he doesn't have a way into that. He hasn't felt the sense of piety that gives him answers that someone like his sister has, for example. He hasn't felt the sort of urge to pray the way his father does, the sort of love for scripture the way his brother, who's a minister, does. And so he has no way into the faith that is meaningful, that he has found to be meaningful to him, and like that he really can grasp onto. And so I think that that leaves him feeling like, as he would have been taught, that he's probably damned forever, or that possibly he's damned forever. That like, you know, he might believe in God, but like he has a hard time with the faith question. And doesn't feel like he's got a way if your eternal life depends on your piety and to some degree, using the word loosely, then he has very little of the piety quotient. Mm-hmm. Innately, instinctively, however you want to put it. And I know that that's not what the theology says. I'm not saying that the theology says piety is what ties your salvation, but
I grew up in a Reformed household. Most Calvinists would say, if you ask the question, am I saved? And if you are tormented by the idea that you're not, then you're not truly unregenerate, because an unregenerate person doesn't care about God, isn't seeking. No, there's none who seeks after God. No, not one. Right. So if you're asking the question, there is some evidence of prevenient grace. But what's interesting about Jack, this is a giant question mark for me. I can't tell if his questions about the faith have anything to do with a true desire to know or engage with the faith, or true fear for his soul, or if it's just he's been trained so much and it's about pleasing his parents and his father and trying to resolve those relationships in some way.
His life has been so broken, and the only way to solve it is to make some peace with his family type scenario.
Right. Yes. Like his concern isn't with God. It's with his dad. But I don't know. That's not a statement. It's a question. I really can't see, because he does ask Glory, like, please save me, little sister. But he also says, I am not repentant. Regret is not the same thing as repentance.
But does he know himself? Like, that's the big thing that I think one of the big questions this book is asking is, there's all these ideas that when he says something like that, that's true. Like, you can look at the things that he says and be like, that's a profound idea that I should think about. But does he actually know himself? And like, is the questioning itself, to even think, to contemplate that, is it like a sort of repentance on its own?
Right. And I think that's a really good question. If you look at what Calvin actually said, not what people say Calvin said, but what Calvin truly said,
you're opening up a real can of worms here.
Well, but it is important, because otherwise it's too easy to dismiss this if you're not a Calvinist.
Right.
It's too easy to say, well, you know, I don't believe that. And so this is a false dilemma that's being created by Marilyn
and
Robinson.
And we do know that Robinson...
Calvin.
She's a Calvinist. Not a Calvinist.
Yes.
She's a Calvinist.
She's read Calvin. She's not taking any of this from like a Google search. But his whole point, again, is if you show any evidence of caring about God, that's evidence of grace. You cannot be a person who wants God's grace and then is denied it. That's not double predestination. So if you have any longing for God, that's only given by God. And so it's, there's no such thing as someone standing outside the door and banging on the door of the faith and being like, let me in, let me in, let me in. No, I'm sorry, you're damned for destruction. That's not Calvin's teachings. And what we do see, I think we do see enough of a question mark in Jack that could be evidence of some kind of intervening grace in his life. And I think that's really important, not to just dismiss this as like, well, it's just double predestination. I don't believe that. There's a real question about the state of his soul because he is so tormented by it.
I think this is actually a good place to stop because I think that this is an idea that the rest of the book explores.
Yeah.
Like, where might there be examples of grace at work in his life? Where might we see examples of him reaching, longing, questions of the ultimate fate of his soul, which, you know, just a little thing like that. So let's go ahead and wrap it up. And I mean, I guess that's just as easy if when I usually ask, what are you going to be looking for? I'll just check that box there for me. Is there anything else you want to add to that?
No.
Okay. Well, then let's stop there. And then next week we'll dive in a little bit further. And like I said, Sarah Jane, SJ is going to be joining us to talk about pages 150 to 200, roughly. I think that's what it was. Don't forget that we will be diving into the next section, next couple chapters of The Lord of the Rings, and you can join the conversation, all that. Don't forget to head over to scholeacademy.com to learn more about how you can submit a tutoring request if you want some classical restful tutoring services to help supplement the education of your child. We're really grateful to them. Really glad to be friends with them too, above all. So thanks to Scholae Academy for being our friends and for supporting the show. Heidi, thank you so much for doing this as always.
No, thanks, David. This is, now we're in the middle of the meat.
That's right. What is the middle of a pancake? Flour.
Definitely not the meat.
They've eaten a lot of breakfast food in this. Let's just say that. Lots of toast, eggs. I think she did make a roast chicken at one point. So maybe we can still go with meat. But
like a hobbit.
Yeah, exactly. All right. With that, for Heidi White, I'm David Kern. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time, happy reading.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.